This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. My guest today is Zeon Lights. She's a former spokesperson for the extreme environmental group Extinction Rebellion. We're going to talk about them and what they're about. She's one of the most persuasive and insistent voices in favor of nuclear technology and clean energy. Her new book is Energy is Life, Why Environmentalism Went Nuclear, which has been praised by people who have been guests on this show, such as Steven Pinker and Michael Shermer. Zeon Lights, thanks for talking Reason.
Thanks for having me on here. It's a pleasure to be here.
All right. I want to start before we get to kind of the your conversion and like a couple of big public kind of moments that you had in England or in Britain. Your book, which is an incredible read, you open with a discussion of a saucepan that your parents had. It's one of the few things they were emigres have roots in India. They came to Great Britain in the, late 50s, early 60s. And you talk about a saucepan. And, you know, it's just kind of strange in a book that is about energy and is about environmentalism and about politics and nuclear energy. You start with a pan. Why? Explain a little bit about the pan.
So it's really about connecting how many things in our life are related to energy, because it's not something we tend to think about. And when I say energy, I mean electricity. And of course, a saucepan's a good example. When you not on the surface, but when you think a little bit deeper about it, it doesn't work unless you have access to electricity. Now, in India, where my parents left, you know, quite bad rural poverty, they didn't have access to electricity, and that village where they're from still doesn't. So some people might have a bit more money, they might have access to a generator, but that's still very limited energy. And it was only when I was there that I started thinking about scarcity in this way, because living here, growing up here my whole life, I'd never experienced it. And even then, you know, I wouldn't say I really experienced it, because that was a choice. I was on holiday, you know, visiting family over there. And the amount of things I had to reevaluate to really accept that, you know, an energy, I've called the book Energy is Life because it underpins everything. Every time I saw a problem there, I thought, you could solve this, but it wouldn't be, you can solve it with money. It would be, you know, you need a power grid, you need rail lines to be able to get to the hospital. You need all of this infrastructure, and all of it comes down to needing electricity. So the saucepan is a good example, because my mum obviously knew this, but she never expressed it to me. She's a woman of very little words, to be honest. She worked in a factory, and both my parents are factory workers. All those factories are derelict now, all shut down. But there was a big industrial boom at that time in Birmingham, where I was born and raised. And so she used to make these pans. She used to work at the machinery on her feet all day. She lost her hearing in one ear because there was not a lot of health and safety back there. It was very loud. But she never complained, because she had a job, she had an income. She had a kind of freedom and liberty that she, you know, no one in generations of her family had ever known. And so these saucepans were just, and I didn't know this, you know, but she was so amazed that she could make these for people, but she couldn't afford one, right? Because they came here with nothing. They were starting from scratch. So for a long time, she couldn't afford one. So when she could, she finally bought home some pans. I remember them being passed around. Mm-hmm. And we were just kids. We were thinking, you know, we just wanted the latest gadget. Why are mum and dad getting us to like sit around and hold this saucepan and pass it around? It wasn't until I was an adult that I understood what it meant. And there's many different things. But essentially, you have a saucepan that big, which is the one she's given me, right? And I still have it to this day. It's in the cupboard. It means two things. It means you can cook for your family, because it's a large pan. Again, I didn't see anything of that caliber when I was in rural India, because there's no way you can buy it. People don't have the income to buy it. If they had people visiting and they left behind cans, as in, you know, like a tin can that they had beans or something in, they would cook on that. They would use that as a saucepan on a crude fire. And to have that fire, they've been collecting debris all day. They've been collecting dung. They've been collecting wood. So it's really polluting. You're sitting there, the women are all sitting there coughing over these fumes. That is how many people, not just in India, also Africa, traditionally cook. A saucepan is a huge step up. So that's why she didn't give me jewelry. You know, she gave me saucepan, and she never explained it, but I came to understand it later. You can feed your family this means you have a source of good electricity, because you can't cook. You couldn't have a plant that big in this where she grew up anyway, because they're using these small fires. It's freedom. It's liberty. Yeah. And of course, she bought it with her own money, which was just such a huge thing.
Kind of amazing too. And I mean, in a way, your parents move from rural areas to cities, to urban cities, and to work in factories kind of replicates England's Industrial Revolution or the American Industrial Revolution, which came later. And I think all of my grandparents left Europe, came to America and worked in factories because it was better. It's also interesting just when you say your mother comes home with the saucepan that she bought with her own money that she made and she's proud of it. It's an interesting kind of refutation of Marx, of, you know, the working class being alienated from the product of their labor. It's like she's kind of excited that she can give it to her children.
Yeah.
Well, you know, I mean, that encapsulates a lot of what the book is about. But could you do, you know, what's kind of like a thesis line of Energia's life?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's kind of there in the title. It's kind of there in that chapter about the saucepan. But basically, everything we do underpins energy and is underpinned by energy. And if we don't move up the ladder, if we don't move away from a crude fire to, you know, coal, gas, to nuclear and renewables, then we stay in a state of poverty. And that's not, you know, I don't think that's a kind of tenable position that anyone can hold. I think a lot of people hold it because they've never had an experience of poverty. And again, as I say, I haven't really directly, I've seen it, but I haven't lived it truly in a true way. But, you know, I would like people to read that book and take away from it that we can step away from that mindset that prosperity, earning a wage, capitalism even to some degree is bad. Like, and that those are all lessons that I was taught constantly growing up here, constantly.
Who was teaching them to you? I mean, was it the overall educational system and kind of cultural system? Was it people more on the left? Or, you know, one of the things that's interesting from, you know, between a kind of British and an American context is that even the right wingers, even the Tories, you know, in Britain seem to be very comfortable kind of shitting on capitalism and not being very individualistic.
They set the net zero goals. Yeah.
Yeah. But is it everywhere kind of in England and in Europe more properly?
Honestly, I think it's ubiquitous. And that makes it very hard to step out of the thinking. So when I was growing up, you know, there were adverts on TV telling you to use less water. I mean, really silly stuff like when you're brushing your teeth, make sure you turn off the tap.
Oh,
and that's just one example. But it was so constant. You did learn it at school. Not a huge part of it, but it was in there. I don't want to say people shamed you for not doing it, but it was, you know, you got told off if you left the lights on when you left the room. That was how it was. I still think it's like that, but I think there's more pushback now. But absolutely, it's come from left and right. It's come from left and right. Yeah.
It's the backdrop. It's
very much I want to say it's almost like a purity thing. I think some countries have it worse. I think, for example, Germany, it's worse. Yeah. And you really do get shamed there for certain.
They have a real historical problem with purity, right? With taking purity too far.
And it's not as policed here. So, for example, like with the recycling and stuff, it's not as policed, but it's cultural. It's taught to you everywhere. And then because I also joined, you know, environmental groups, that's their sole message. So it's all about capitalism's bad, live with less. Why are you wasteful? We're wasteful. And underpinning all of that is just humans are bad. Humans shouldn't be living on the planet.
Is it, you know, and I want to talk about Extinction Rebellion as a particular group because they're fascinating in a moment. But, you know, in the environmentalist movement, as you encountered it, or even in just that larger kind of superstructure that's all encompassing, I mean, is it that people are bad, so fewer people will be better, but also, you know, it's just the idea that, like, even if we had unlimited power that was non-polluting and that did nothing bad, didn't use up any energy, we should still control our use because it's unseemly. I mean, is there almost a religious aspect?
Absolutely. So when I first started questioning nuclear, I hadn't come around to it because I, you know, believed a lot of nonsense about it for a long time. But even when I started questioning it, people would say, some people in the movement, quite, you know, prominent figures would say, I'm not actually against technology. I just don't think humans should have the right to have access to that. And it is a weird sort of self-flagellation. We stay poor, we stay struggling. And if you look at the people that most advocate for living on the land, living off grid, they are advocating for a kind of suffering hard lifestyle. And I always say that this is, it's fascinating because it's that, that is a product of prosperity. People who live in poverty don't want that. That's how they live. The people who've grown up with everything and all the privilege are idolizing, you know, a way of life that nobody else wants.
Is it just a form of guilt, do you think, of that 100%. I, you know, you get raised in a way where, and it can be within, you know, England or within the UK or within Europe or within the whatever we want to call the West, you know, for this moment, et cetera. Is it just, well, I have more and other people have less and I feel guilty?
I think it's guilt. And that's also why it's worse in Germany. I don't think, I mean, I think it's interesting, and I have read about and thought about this a lot because I think people can come at it with different reasons. But ultimately, I do think there's a lot of guilt about just doing well and just, you know, living well and having what you need. And I wouldn't say that it's about empathy for people in poverty, because if it was, you would want them to leave poverty. And I would give that example. I would say, well, my parents, you know, when I was trying to balance the two views, well, my parents escaped this, and they were, and I literally had the leader of the Green Party at the time. I was on a debate with her, and she said, "But they were happier, Zion." And I was so shocked that I didn't say anything. I didn't say anything. I had to go away and process what she just told me. They don't. Yeah. She said they don't have mental health crises like we do. Oh. Are you telling me that in a society where the infant mortality rate is so high? And the respiratory rate so high, and the rate, even rabies rates and snake bites, because they don't have access to medication or healthcare, that they have better mental health. I mean, they don't have statistics. I can't show you statistics to prove otherwise, because no one is going, you know, 4 hours from the nearest airport to go and gather the data.
Did you ask your parents? Yeah, did you ask your parents? Were they happier?
I have actually, and it's interesting because when I was a kid, they always said they wanted to go back. But that's because, you know, they're from a culture where family is so important, and they left behind all their family. So they lost their parents while they were over here. They lost siblings while they were over here. They, you know, there was always some letter in the post from India. Somebody else has died. Like, it was sad. They couldn't go to funerals. They didn't have the money to constantly go back and forth. They didn't go back for a long time. And actually, they didn't go back for something like 10, 15 years. And then they took me as a teenager. And the entire, we spent 2 weeks in this village off grid, and they were stressed out the entire time, and they wanted to go home. And we only stayed because, you know, people expect us to be there, and they loved us being there, and they're sharing their food. We felt guilty for eating the food when we could see how little they had. And again, it's not that you can't, it's not something that just money resolves. Like, you need the infrastructure, which means bringing in the electricity as well, but the infrastructure, because you can give them money, but if they can't get somewhere to buy more rice, they don't have more rice. They're rice farmers. That's what they do. They grow rice. And it varies depending, completely weather dependent, you know, vocation. But I remember walking, just walking, you know, in Sandal. It was so hot there. It's 40 degree heat. I'm walking in the heat, and my dad pulls me away. And I said, "What are you doing?" You know, it's quite like a violent motion. And he thought he saw, and maybe he did see, a snake in the grass. And they do have a lot of snakes, right? They live in nature. Yeah. Mm-hmm. They don't see the nature the way that we see nature. Right. It's like, oh, so lovely, and we want more. No, they it's a war, because I had a cousin that was lost to a snake bite there, actually. And it's a really horrific death that was described to me in detail, because everyone just gathered around and tried to make it easier for him.
That is, the idea of nature as a place you want to visit and hang out and maybe return to is, you know, really is a 19th century creation of, you know, people like Shelley and Keats after, they had more money, right?
I think with the nature is red in tooth and claw, right? To say, my parents, after that, they admitted it, that they couldn't live there after having escaped that, because they couldn't settled with the fact that, you might get bitten by a snake. The people there live with it because it's their reality. If you have a choice, you will not choose that You would not give up everything, you know, even though they desperately wanted to be back with their family. They always said, when we retire, we'll go back there. Well, they've been retired for a long time and they don't even visit.
What do you think in Europe more broadly, or, you know, let's say the former EU, so we can include Britain in it for a bit. You know, you mentioned that a lot of people, even Greens, but also, you know, more broadly, it's they don't want people in poorer nations to have, you know, abundant energy or access to this lifestyle. And then increasingly, they don't want those people to migrate or to emigrate, you know, to the UK or to Europe. And in America, we have a version of this. How do you explain that? Like, it's one thing, okay, I feel guilty about everything I have and other people don't have, so I'm going to torture myself. You know, if you're raised in a, particularly in Christian religions, but others, you feel guilty. So you make yourself feel bad, but not that bad. But then what do you do with this idea of like, okay, I feel guilty, but I'm going to do whatever I can to make sure that the developing world never reaches a higher standard of living?
I mean, I think it's just a cognitive dissonance. People just don't realize how other people are living, even though, you know, we do have a relative kind of poverty here. And I appreciate that. And that's where a lot of that frustration is coming from. You know, often they'll say, well, you know, we need more jobs or houses or whatever. These are, as you know, systemic issues. They're not to do with the number of people coming here. In fact, a lot of them fill vacancies that aren't otherwise filled, especially like in the NHS and stuff. But I can understand why they kind of connect those two things and they get frustrated. It's easy to just pick. I mean, that's always happened across history. We'll pick that group. Honestly, I think a lot of these things, and it's the same with nuclear. It's not, people asked me, why were you against nuclear? And I might say waste, I might say Chernobyl, but the truth is, I didn't have an argument. It was just a feeling. It's just a feeling. And I think that's all it is. It's a feeling of guilt. That's what the environmentalists have. The other side that say we don't want people coming in, it's just a feeling that if there were less of us, things would be better, which actually historically has never really been the case, right? Like, we have more progress, more prosperity when there's more people. Nobody believes that. That's one of the most controversial things that I've ever said that I've had so much pushback on. Because even though all the data shows that, people just, for some reason, they have a feeling, but we're bad, so how can that be true? If there's too many of us, that can't be true. And it's very hard to unpick that and debate with these people or get them to see your opinion, because it's just a feeling, like a, like almost like a religious belief. And you
so how did it, well, let's talk about you and joining Extinction Rebellion, or, I mean, you were involved in various kinds of environmentalist causes, and certainly more so than in the United States. Both, you know, anything across the Atlantic has like actual green parties or environmentalist movements that really have political power can express that. But what drew you to a group like Extinction Rebellion? And could you, for an American audience, just explain a little bit about what it is?
So Extinction Rebellion posits itself as a group that's there to fight climate change. Very good branding. All the branding is very organic. A lot of creative people were involved. You know, they've got the extinction symbol, which they took on loan actually from an artist who would decide where you could use it on what literature or not. Like, it's very organized in that way. And yeah, the entire premise is, you know, we want to protect the planet, we want to protect people and the life on it, hence Extinction Rebellion. But I would say, as someone who was a core member who got right to the top with the founders, that's not what the group is. And if you look carefully at their three demands, you can actually see what their actual policies are, because that's what they came up with when they formed the group. First one was just like, they wanted a climate emergency declared. Fine. A lot of councils did that. The government did that. They got that. But the third one is the important one, because the third one, the second one was the net zero. They also got achieved that goal. The third one was the important one, because it was the rule was to go beyond politics and set up a fairer system. And their idea of a fairer system was something like citizens' assemblies, where people make decisions instead of like a broad government. But actually, what I realized from hanging out with the people that came up with this, the small group that sat down before I joined and wrote this out, they want political revolution. And I would even go so far as saying it's not really about climate change. That's just a useful lever. And it's certainly not about protecting people. In fact, people are the problem. That is what they would say. But I was attracted to it because I believed their marketing. And when I realized the marketing was convincing but fake, then I stepped away.
Why? I mean, and the shift in kind of system changes is one from a kind of liberal political system with, with capitalism or free enterprise as the economic organizing principle to a much more regimented socialist, may not be quite the right word, but it turns out it's an authoritarian system where people have less scope for individual choices on everything.
Yeah, basically. But again, it was marketed very cleverly.
Right.
It was sort of people will have more. In fact, this was a talking point that I was given. When you go on TV, say more democracy. We want more democracy. But what they actually wanted was for them to be in charge because everybody else has ruined the planet and they're the good guys and they're going to fix it by telling you how to live. And that's not an exaggeration. Like some of the things I would say about people shouldn't be allowed to take flights. People shouldn't be allowed to go in their cars. It's quite... Those were the actual views that you wouldn't see written anywhere. And that's where it really clashed with me thinking, well, you know, having those things is what gives you a better quality of life. It means you can get to the hospital. Oh, but we'll just have buses that can take everyone everywhere. Okay, it's a nice idea. We do have buses, but it takes away a lot of freedom from people. But again, I think the idea is, well, they deserve that. They deserve to suffer because look what they did to the planet.
So let's talk a little bit about nuclear and your kind of migration towards, nuclear energy is actually it's the source that we need now, really, ramped up, scaled up tremendously, and other forms of renewable energy and non-carbon energy can get there, but we need nuclear. You had said before, the kind of anti-nuclear sensibility is a feeling, it's a vibe. Where does that come from? The idea that, nuclear is, nuclear is not just bad, but we really need to get rid of it as it exists now. And the reason I bring this up in a United States context, in the early 60s, there were two big student groups. There was a right-wing group called Young Americans for Freedom and a left-wing group called Students for Democratic Society. And in their founding statements, which came out within a couple months of each other, they both took for granted. And I mean, it's kind of remarkable. This is in 1962. They both took for granted that we would have cheap, renewable, non-polluting energy, and it would be nuclear energy. That was like the background assumption. And, certainly by the end of the 60s, nuclear energy was going nowhere in America. So I realize Britain has a different history with this, but how does nuclear energy go from being the future to being the one thing that we absolutely have to get rid of?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this shift happened well before I was born. And then obviously I kind of inherited it for a while. And certainly a lot of the fear from speaking to older people in those movements was from conflating it with weapons. But I still think that that was done deliberately. And I think basically there were several parties that funded. And we know that some of these environmental groups like Sierra Club, which is American, and Greenpeace and other groups were known to take donations from certain industries, including fossil related industries. And Sierra Club was founded on the basis of, well, we're an environmental group, but one of our biggest policies is to campaign against nuclear. We also know that they were very successful, not just in political lobbying here across Europe and in America, but in changing public perception. I think that's the main thing, that it was almost like a psyop, I think. And because it was before my time, it's hard to really know, but it's interesting when I have spoken to people about their fears and the same fears that I absorbed, for example, about waste. If you say nuclear to anyone, even today, waste.
Yeah, what are you going to do with the waste? That stuff never goes away.
You never hear that when someone says coal. If you say coal, no one says waste. And we're breathing in that waste. It's stored in the Earth's atmosphere. Yeah. We know it's a problem. It's polluting. Right. It's right down there at the bottom of the, fine. If you have nothing else and you need to escape poverty, yes, it's useful. Mm-hmm. It's cheap. Right. You can burn a lot of it. That's what's happening. But even those countries, India, China, are trying to transition to cleaner fuels because they know there's an immense cost there. And even they are building nuclear. So why would the countries in the West reject it? And you haven't seen that there, right? You haven't seen it in China. You haven't seen it in India. They just haven't even had the movement. They haven't had the environmental groups and the lobbying. So I think there were bad actors that put money into these groups. Some of them, you know, founded the groups on this basis so that they would do the environmental stuff, but include in that lobbying against nuclear. And even to the point that nuclear got put in its own category instead of being classed as like renewable. That's quite a clever framing, because not all renewables are, you know, I would say that's not a good term. Some are reliable, some are less reliable, some are polluting. I mean, biomass is very polluting. It's classed as renewable, it gets the subsidies, right? I think it's really interesting. Those decisions were made deliberately. I don't think it was accidental. I think they were made deliberately years before I was born, and then they just carried on. And I think, you know, pop culture helped to carry it on. You know, you had the bad depiction in The Simpsons. I grew up with that. It's not that I watched The Simpsons and turned against nuclear. It just reinforced ideas I had. Of course, the industry person's the most evil. You know, of course, the nuclear workers messing around and being dangerous.
All the fish have three eyes.
All the fish have three eyes. The waste is green liquid in a yellow barrel. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you something. I just started watching this sci-fi series recently. I'm really into sci-fi, and a lot of people said, go and watch this. It's called Dark, right? And it's German. And it's in German. And don't listen for a minute if you don't want spoilers, but this shocked me. This is a new series, and the entire premise is that there's a nuclear power plant that has caused really bad things to happen, without giving everything away. And it starts by panning out on a nuclear plant. And I thought, that's interesting. But I thought, surely it's still not going to be propaganda. Even now, even after most of the public there has said we shouldn't have shut down the plants, even after Chancellor Merz has come out and said we shouldn't have done that, even now the propaganda is so strong. And I actually did a Substack article on this where I looked at why is Germany out in Europe? Germany is the most vehemently anti-nuclear. I've actually given talks where I've been shouted at by people in the audience, and it's always been a German person. The only time it's happened, one was asked to leave because he was so angry that I was talking about nuclear. They've had so much propaganda for so long. And I urge people to look this up. They have a book called Die Wolke. It's called The Cloud. Uh-huh. I read this book, and it's traumatizing. It's about a little kid in a nuclear disaster, but although it's a meltdown, the effects are what you would expect after an atomic bomb. And there's no difference in the book. And this is a very famous book, and it's taught in German schools to this day. Wow. And I've got German friends who said, yeah, I grew up reading that. I was terrified. And that's propaganda.
That's fascinating to think about the conflation of nuclear energy and a nuclear bomb, because obviously Germany in the 70s and 80s had the most forward anti-nuclear weapon or the denuclearization of weapons and power. What about how do you deal with realities like serious nuclear power plant problems? Chernobyl is obviously the most obvious one, and then more recently something like Fukushima, or earlier something like Three Mile Island in the United States. You're not saying that nuclear energy has no risks, right? Or no dangers. Sure. It's just that when you put these things in various kinds of cost-benefit analyses and compare them to things like coal plants and oil and gas refining and things like that, the kind of the mathematics of costs and benefits change a bit.
And also, if people's primary concern tends to be safety, and actually, there's good data on this. You can look at Arwood and data or somewhere like that that's done a good breakdown of the numbers. It's one of the safest forms of energy. Mm-hmm. Like, it is right down there with solar and wind. Even hydropower has a higher toll because of the Bankyo Dam disaster, which killed over 100,000 people. Their homes completely washed away. Nuclear has never done that. And I'm not saying, that's good that, only 2,000 people died at Chernobyl. It's not good when someone dies, obviously. But you can't consider something like electricity out of context. You have to look at the context. Coal is the worst, absolute worst on every metric. I feel like that's quite well known by now. Nuclear is one of the best. So, and with Chernobyl, there's a really good way to just explain Chernobyl, which is we don't build that reactor anymore, the RBMK reactor, because the original design had a risk that it could explode. Modern reactors can't. They just can't. And the few that still exist in that part of the world, in Russia, they have upgraded them so that they can't explode. So we'll never have another Chernobyl. We might have a meltdown, but we wouldn't have anything of that scale. That was just that reactor. There are much better designs now. And even Fukushima, they found in a report afterwards that they could have chosen a design that would have actually withstood a tsunami, and they didn't. So there were lessons learned there. But again, ultimately, no one died from that meltdown. I mean, right. It's terrible. Lots of people.
I mean, more people died from the evacuation process.
Yeah, because
right,
they panicked.
From radiation. Yeah.
Yeah, they panicked and got into accidents. And I often say the fear of nuclear is actually worse than nuclear itself.
Yeah.
And that's why we need to make sensible decisions. And again, another report found actually a lot of those people didn't need to be evacuated, but the people in charge panicked. Again, lessons to be learned there. But essentially, you know, Japan learned that lesson very quickly. And I do, that's why I make that kind of distinction that isn't it interesting that the East hasn't had this pushback on nuclear and like moving away from it. They've always been kind of guns blazing. Japan did initially shut them down. But very soon after they realized electricity became expensive, they were building renewables, but it wasn't enough. They didn't want to go back to fossil fuels. They started reopening them, and they're still in the process of restarting reactors. They didn't have that. Without all the additional kind of storytelling around it, people make more sensible decisions.
And if any country has, you know, the direct experience with nuclear weapons, it's Japan, right? So it's kind of particularly remarkable that they are very forward in terms of nuclear energy. In the book, you talk about part of this is you can see kind of nuclear energy as captive to grand narratives of historical rivalries, that go back hundreds of years. But in Europe, for instance, you have Germany, which basically got rid of all of its nuclear energy and put itself, at risk, not only to use more polluting forms of energy, but, it becomes something approaching a vassal state to Russia, while France, which is also kind of, France has long been the leading kind of developed nation with nuclear power. But explain, how do the different paths taken by countries like France and Germany help show why nuclear energy is really still underappreciated as a source of clean and ongoing energy?
So even in France, I was there a few years ago protesting the shutdown of Fessenheim. So they shut down a reactor. It was old, but it wasn't past its expiry date. It could have been extended. They made the decision not to extend it. And that was under Macron's government. Even though he's always been very pro-nuclear publicly, there was so much campaigning at that time. And it was really, even though Extinction Rebellion was founded here, I have never experienced that level of campaigning. It was all in the news. Greenpeace flying drones into the site saying, look how unsafe it is, we can fly a drone. I mean, what is a drone going to do? It's not going to do anything. But people didn't know that. And the press had a heyday. Activists fly drone into nuclear unsafe zone. And he basically caved to those pressures. And it was only later, after the narrative started kind of shifting in favor, that he made an announcement, we're going to build new reactors, which is great. And they are building them. But there was a point where even France lagged. And so they went from having 80% nuclear to down to 70. So even there, they could not withstand it. The lobbying was so powerful. And no one does any diligence on this. No one goes and looks at where is that money coming from. And I've inquired. I've contacted some of these groups, and they're not transparent about their funding. Who is funding them to lobby so heavily? And especially, in Germany, the coal industry benefited, right? Because they did this for environmental reasons, but then they had to go back to burning coal because they didn't have enough wind and solar on the grid. And again, in Germany, the level of lobbying and campaigning is just, I've never seen it in any other country, France and Germany. Now, France managed to withstand it and kind of bounce back. Germany has learned the lesson the hard way, really expensive electricity. Polls do show now that most people kind of say you shouldn't have shut them down. But it's interesting that there was so much campaigning. I went there and gave a talk on the day that the last reactor was shut down. And there was a huge Greenpeace present, like opposite the square, and there's police separating us. They had this massive dinosaur, which was representing nuclear. And they had a guy with a sun for a face stabbing the dinosaur, representing solar. And I thought that was interesting because it was a really big installation. And I thought, that's a lot of money has been spent on that. Where is that money? From
And it's also interesting to figure nuclear power as a dinosaur, right? Since it was going to replace fossil fuels, which there's a big, gas station chain in America called Sinclair, whose, mascot was a big dinosaur, because that's oil and gas comes from.
I mean, solar is not a new technology either. Yeah. But it doesn't matter. You know, again, it's feelings. It's what, and lots of people, tourists were coming and having photos taken with this.
Sure.
And reinforcing that idea to them. This is a good thing. Yeah. All these people are partying. And yeah, I just thought it was really interesting because I think these are completely funded operations, but no one goes and actually.
So is it, it's funded by industry? Is it funded by rival governments? Where are the Gulf states in all this? Yeah.
They get grants and they get donations from individuals. But I'll tell you something, in Extinction Rebellion, I went to some of their donor events. They're private events and only like the real top brass in the organization were allowed to go. Celebrities who don't want to go on record as giving you money, but will write you a big check. We had major banks writing us checks at some of these events.
Why would a major bank do that? Especially anonymous.
Exactly. I don't know. Hmm. I don't know, but
who was the biggest celebrity that you saw?
Benedict Cumberbatch was at our events. Oh.
Yeah.
And he had some, I remember he had some selfies taken and he asked for us not to post them online and then people did. And it was in the news on the front page the next day. But isn't it interesting that it wasn't meant to be visible? Like there were a lot of people, there were a lot of A-listers at these events. I'm trying to think who else. But banks, big CEOs, people I'd never heard of, people from overseas that all, you know, there's a lot of hype about this group that we'd give some presentations, we'd give out lots of, you know, champagne, and then we'd sweet talk people into writing us checks, basically. And none of that was anywhere in the press. No one was checking. And I wondered, is this even allowed? I don't even know if it was actually.
Your kind of association with Extinction Rebellion, which is famous for doing kind of these mass stoppages in various places, in subways and, you know, on roadways and things like that. You write about it in the book, where in 2019 you appeared on a show and you were, you kind of had to admit that there was not a good argument that the group had against nuclear power. Can you talk a little bit about that? You had already become a believer in nuclear energy as a way forward. But you know, the group is very much against that. So can you set that scene a little bit and walk us through what happened?
So, well, the interesting thing is I had already changed my mind on nuclear and I had left a lot of these groups that I'd been involved with before very heavily. And so when they invited me to join, I wasn't a founding member. They said, Zion, we love your work. We know you've been in this space. Will you come and be a spokesperson? All you have to do is go on TV and talk about climate science. I was like, yeah, okay, I'll do that. I'd rather I did that than you have someone talking nonsense about it and setting the whole thing back, right? Although they did do that anyway, but it was a different spokesperson. But I was invited on the Andrew Neil show, really big TV program. He's a very forensic interviewer. And before I went on, they had Tony Blair on. So it was a lot of people watched it and it was live. And the thing is, I sat there and I realized, you know, I had been told. So, yeah, when I was invited, I had said, well, you know, I'm pro-nuclear, know some other stuff. And they were like, we don't care about that. All we care about is climate. That was their branding. So I thought, oh, okay, I can do this. So I went on this show. It was not my first rodeo, but I had my talking points. And I think they'd researched me really well. They knew I wasn't just going to say, yeah, just wind and solar will do it. They knew I wasn't going to say people are bad. We need to have less people. And he really grilled me specifically on those points. So, for example, he kept saying, what are we going to do with that gas then? What do you think we should do with that gas? And I'm thinking of my talking points that I've been given by this organization. Just tell him we need system change. Just tell him we need more democracy. You know, none of them matched up. And fine, another spokesperson might have done that. But I remember just sitting there under this spotlight and just thinking, I can't do this anymore because actually I think it's doing more harm than good at this point. And I wish, sometimes I think I wish I should have had just gone and said nuclear, but I, as a representative for the group, I couldn't. But then when I left, I came out and did it anyway, so it's fine. But he kept pressing on that point because he knew that I couldn't say, just wind and solar. And actually what I said, and this clip was put online and seen, it was watched by over 2 million people. I said, I don't have any answers for you. But it's true. It's true, because none of that's in, there's no energy policy within their policies, because they just believe that we shouldn't be using it.
Right.
That's it. You should have one solar panel on your roof, and that's it. And when it runs out, that's your fault. You use too much. That's it.
Do you, I mean, your general take is that nuclear energy is the technology we have now that can supply much of our needs. And then we can add on things like solar and wind. And it's just that they are not capable of supplying all the needs of the grid all the time.
So they can't supply 24/7. They do require battery storage, which no one ever factors into the cost and the infrastructure. You're building a new grid, so you're building new infrastructure. I'm not against that. I think it is good to have multiple different clean energy sources. And I think it's a shame that the fight is always renewables versus nuclear, right? How clever is that really if you're the fossil fuel industry? When it should be just clean, let's just get rid of what's not clean. That's not even political. It's not left or right. It's just, it's damaging us. It's damaging the planet. Let's move to more progressive sources. Nuclear, nuclear is so powerful. And obviously that's been used against it in many ways within the narrative, but you can power an entire civilization with this without damaging the world around you. That's the thing. Like, yes, it has an environmental impact. I'm not denying that. But if you look at the mining costs, there's data on this, it has less because it produces so much per kilowatt hour. It has very little impact. It takes up very little space. People don't realize that often. It has a really small land footprint compared to wind and solar. I'm not saying don't build them. I'm just saying actually on every metric, when I started looking at it, I was thinking every single thing I've been told about this is a lie. And even the way it's so minimal, so little of it, so well, absurdly well managed, while, you know, even waste from other industries just isn't, which should be managed well, isn't. Because nuclear's had that history. So it's almost been, you know, the thing with nuclear is we've been so obsessed with trying to get to zero risk. Nothing is zero risk. Nothing can be zero risk, right? Like you, even just me sitting here is not zero risk. Walking around your house is not zero risk. A lot of accidents happen at home. Every time you get in a car, you're taking a big risk. Nothing is zero risk. But because of all that pushback in this side of the world, we have regulated it and overregulated it and made it more expensive than it needs to be. And I say that because if you look at how much China or Japan has spent, or South Korea is a good example because they have such a good reactor that they're exporting it around the world. It's so cheap compared to over here because we take a design and then it has to go through our environmental standards, which is ironic, right? Because it's actually slowing down the building of clean energy.
That will save the environment.
Yeah. And once those things are in place, it's very hard to get rid of them. So even with people that I know who are like, yeah, we want nuclear. If you say you want to reduce regulation, that scares them. But I'm not talking about making it less safe. I'm talking about when we build the EPR, so we don't have our own reactor. We have the European pressurized reactor from France. You're supposed to just take that design and build it like a Lego set, just keep repeating it. But we don't do that because we have to make design changes to meet our own standards. So the concrete's got to be a bit thicker. You can only use these kinds of nails. If there's a problem with the supply chain, then there's a delay. And actually, you know, our latest reactor that hasn't come online yet, it's going to be amazing. It's going to power 6 million homes. That's huge, especially for the site, which I've been to see. It's so small for how much power. It's crazy. But it's delayed by over a decade. I mean, it's ridiculous. And he's looking at South Korea, making them 3 or 4 years, and then going abroad to the UAE and saying, yeah, we'll make them for you. Let's make some more in 3 or 4 years. That's really hard now that's embedded in our system. That's really hard.
What role, and this may be more specific to the United States, and I will confess a total ignorance of you know, the local industries in other parts of the world, but they, the nuclear energy industry here is very, it's a product of the federal government. It's been regulated, a government that has done everything it can to lose the trust and confidence of people across all sorts of areas of activity. The industry itself often lies, you know, the people involved in it, and they get huge subsidies and things like that. How much of the problem of building out nuclear do you think goes to the industry itself or the people in the industry, because they have, you know, they're just, they don't come across as honest brokers.
You know, it's funny. So I wouldn't say that the people I've dealt with here are dishonest, but yeah. I would say that there's no sense of urgency. And so, for example, you know, when I started out doing this, one of the first actions I did was I'm going to go down to where they're building this. They're going to build this new reactor in Suffolk. Mm-hmm. Actually, they hadn't approved it yet. It was kind of a subject for debate, but they approved it afterwards. And I saw that there's a celebrity going down there holding all these rallies against it. And that celebrity lives in London and has a second home there. And he said he doesn't want the noise from the construction. So that was his main. Yeah, he said that in like to a newspaper.
Yeah.
So I was like, no, not having that. Got on a train, 5-hour journey. And I got a group of people together, environmentalists actually, who were kind of a bit fed up with the traditional movement. And and we all had a swim on the beach. And the main reason we did that was because the opposing group was saying that the water was radioactive from the power plant, which of course, ridiculous. But that's why we, for good optics, and we did get in the news, we're swimming in the on the beach and stuff. I had an email a couple of days before this event, which I advertised on all my channels, from the industry. And this was the first time I ever had any interaction with the industry after years of thinking they're the bad guys, reassessing it, but then not really having any opinion of them, except, you know, thinking, well, they've been demonized for a long time. That's not fair. And the email from their comms team said, we would like you not to do this event because people will protest it and you'll get bad press. And I was actually really angry. And I replied saying, how could you possibly have a worse image than you already have? If this is what you're doing, discouraging people who are trying to support you, like, no wonder. And I think that's actually a big part of the problem. They never fought back. They never owned things when they've gone wrong and just been transparent and honest about it and calm people down. It can be done. And I always give this example, and I give it in the book, of Challenger. Because if you look at what happened with Challenger, that's horrific, right? There's school teachers up there. There's kids watching on live television. It's one of the most viewed live broadcasts at the time. And it explodes, and they shut it off, and then the teachers have to explain to the kids what they have just seen, and that the debris you're seeing is people who have been, I mean, come on, this is horrific, right? Like, I didn't see it growing up, but I remember learning about it because I'm really into astronomy and stuff, and thinking, wow, that's really horrific. Isn't that funny that people didn't turn against the space industry? I mean, it's far more dangerous when you think about it. It is. Why hasn't there been this big narrative? If you talk about space, you only hear positive, incredible stories, right? Project Hail Mary, that just came out. Absolutely incredible, positive story. All the books that I've ever read about space stuff, from Star Trek to
new stuff. Can I ask, though, then this kind of follows through, because there, in the US, they did stop manned programs for a while or scaled it back.
Yeah.
But the big difference is that the space industry now is a very much of a mix of private enterprise and state enterprise. And you know, in the United States, NASA, our space agency, really only got back on track when it was like, okay, we're going to contract out to a lot of people. And it includes Elon Musk. It includes Jeff Bezos. Mm-hmm. It includes various things. And is there an analog there for the nuclear industry, either globally or in particular places, because they have the urgency? You know, it is Elon Musk, who is a vexing figure. He does, you know, he wants to die on Mars, preferably not on, you know, not on impact and all of that kind of stuff. But like, he's got a sense of urgency that no government anywhere ever sees.
Yeah. But I think the difference with the Challenger thing was, I think that Reagan came out with that incredible speech. I mean, that speech has gone down in history. Mm-hmm. And when you read that, you think, I've never heard anything like that about nuclear. No one has ever come out and owned it. And again, that report on Fukushima said, if they had just come out and calmed people, it would have saved those panicked deaths, but they didn't. And that is an industry problem, lack of sense of urgency, terrible communication. And often, because a lot of them are, you know, engineers and sciencey types, they just don't even necessarily understand the need for that communication, whereas actually that's where we're at with that. And I think, again, but it shows the difference between when you do it and when you don't do it and what happens to that industry. And then it becomes kind of self-fulfilling, I think, because a lot of people I spoke to, for example, at Hinkley Point C, which is the one that's delayed and hopefully going to come on in the next few years, but it's really, really massively delayed. The people who started out working there, fresh graduates, engineers, so excited. I went at the beginning when they were literally clearing the land. I was invited to go and have a look. And then I went again when they were putting the dome on, and they just felt like they'd just given up. They just said, I just want to see this project through now. I kind of want to go do something else. And that you're losing that because of those delays. And I actually think it would be very difficult to reform that. And it needs, you almost do need it to go to a new model. We're not seeing that discussion here, though. I know you're getting it with SpaceX and stuff over there. What we're seeing here is more of a move to small modular reactors. So there are huge commitments to that. People quite like them, although people here are fairly pro-nuclear anyway. They're very well marketed. I mean, the marketing is brilliant. Some of the adverts and stuff, fantastic. People like Rolls-Royce, that's the company here that's building them. But what I would say is you could have them as an addition the same way you have wind and solar. But if you're talking about powering a civilization, if you're talking about lifting people out of poverty, meeting our needs, and not just meeting our needs, but thinking a little bit ahead to what's coming next, it could be data centers, it could be the next revolutionary technology in healthcare. We don't know, right? But there's always new stuff. We're very energy dependent, rich people. It's not going to be enough for that. Like you can have, sure, you can power a data center with an SMR, but can you power an entire country? I think still the safest bet is to build good old big old fashioned nuclear.
Do you worry though at all that like places like China, you know, is one model of a country that is going gangbusters on this stuff, but is deeply authoritarian, and they kind of probably don't care if a lot of people get lost while doing this? Or UAE is another model of a kind of authoritarian country where you know, the little people don't matter. Does that worry you at all?
It does. And I think that's a problem of our own making. That could have been us. We were pioneers of this technology in the early days, and we've completely given that away. I mean, I'm hopeful when I look at things like, you know, the South Korean model. This is not an authoritarian country. They live under the under the shadow of one. They haven't invested in weapons. The other half has, but they actually get quite a lot of prosperity from going for civil nuclear. They've built a brilliant design. They're exporting that design to lots of other countries. I think they just won a new tender somewhere, an African country, can't remember where. But, you know, that makes me a bit more hopeful. But ultimately, you know, we've created a problem. And we're going to have to, I think we're going to have to deal with that problem at some point, because and energy is what supports a civilization. Energy is what brings prosperity. Mm-hmm. We know that. We're watching it happen. And then I'm sitting here watching manufacturing shut down in Germany because their electricity is so expensive. And we've shot ourselves in the foot. And I don't know how long it will be before we will say that's the superpower. And we are poor. We are comparatively poor. And we have the same problem in Britain. Our electricity is very expensive. And it will change once we have more nuclear on the grid, but it's slow. So we just come around in constant circles, no matter who I talk to. I mean, I literally just gave evidence in Parliament on a net zero clean energy panel. I was an expert witness, and I said the whole thing needs reform. No one wanted to hear it. They wanted to hear little nice things, you know, little changes. That's not going to do it. You have to do an Elon Musk. Scrap that and start again. And how do we make it efficient? And how do we punch well above our weight? Because we're actually really good at doing that. We have the expertise to do it. We have the foundation to do it. We have the scientific knowledge, but we don't have the ambition that I'm seeing where China's saying, we're going to build 100 reactors. We're going to build 100 reactors this decade. I mean, if I said that here, people would laugh at me.
What you remain a conservationist and an environmentalist. Beyond the transition to nuclear, what are the other policies that you that you think are really important that are either not being discussed or are going well? I mean, things like carbon taxes or regulation of pollution. Has there been good progress in those either in the way that we think about that, so that we are not necessarily destroying technological innovation, but are getting a cleaner atmosphere?
I think actually that's something that's under-discussed and people don't realize. Mm-hmm. Often when once you get to a stage where you have a kind of cleaner grid and enough money, actually we do put in environmental standards. The US has done that. The UK has done that. There's like a list of 10 countries that have done it the best, and we're in there. France is in there. Actually, that's a really positive thing. And we have brought down emissions. I think people don't realize that, because when they're given the figures by the media or environmentalists, it's always, oh, look, we're using more. But actually, if you look at our emissions, no, we're using more, but we're still conserving more too. We're doing better. Our air's cleaner than ever before, beyond like the occasional, you know, wildfire or whatever, like they have in Canada right now. The rest of the time, it's exceptionally good. It's better than ever before in history. And you're even seeing developing nations trying to do that. Difficult for them because they're still burning coal, but realizing that that actually is important for human health. If they want healthy workers, they need to prioritize that. So even in China, they're looking at how to improve that. So I think there's a lot of good stuff that's happened that we don't hear about. And in terms of environmentalism, some things I changed my mind on, something that, again, you know, it's not talked about a lot, gene editing technology. That's something that another life-changing technology that's so demonized, you know, Frankified food, all of that stuff. I grew up with all of that imagery in my head. I completely changed my mind on it. Saw the studies. Golden rice, brilliant. We should have that. That's where progress is stalled because the environmentalists have directly lobbied, as well as shifting the narrative. They have directly lobbied countries, including poorer countries. Like if you look at what happened in Sri Lanka, where they said, fine, we're going to get rid of all the fertilizers. It's killing our people. Overnight, we're going to go to organic. Well, look at its economy now. They're in intense poverty and they have not recovered. And the guy who brought that policy in, I can't remember his name, he got hounded out of office. He had to like leave the country. And all those farmers are suffering. That every time we fight against a new technological, you know, technological invention or progress, we not only hold ourselves back, but we harm the planet and the wildlife around us. It's not a conservationist thing to hold back on those things. Every time, once people prosper and do better, I mean, we know this from studies that show if people are healthier and they're getting enough food, well, then you're going to have fewer deaths and they're going to have less children. So if that's your concern, that should be the remedy, right? I'm not saying that's the only reason we should help people, but there's a big cognitive dissonance there between what actually helps people and helps the causes you care about, and then the things that you support, which are in direct opposition. And classic example is, of course, nuclear, because every country that has phased out nuclear has ended up increasing its emissions. So there is a lot of
progress. If you're against emissions, you need to be pro-nuclear. You know, we started out talking about the saucepan, which opens your book, and then at the end of the book, you go back to the village as well, or you discuss it. But in the book and in your worldview, energy is is really kind of liberation for all of us, but especially in a current context for women and poor people. What do you think is the most the kind of most important comforter technology that those of us, and again, I use the word West, or the term West in quotation marks, because it varies, you know, minute by minute. But in the developed world, what's a technology or a comfort that we just take for granted that gets lost when we, you know, when we start talking about, environmentalism from an older model?
You mean besides nuclear?
Yeah. What's a comfort or technology that those of us in wealthy countries take for granted that would go away if we actually follow?
Oh, there's just so many kind of environmental. I mean, what about your phone? Mm-hmm. Do you know how much product goes into that phone? How much mining and then construction and the factories and they're quite polluting factories because they're not here where we have high environmental standards. They all moved abroad to countries where they have less strict environmental standards and less respect for the workers as well. Actually, I should add, we didn't want it here. It's polluting. We'll stop doing it. Well, someone else is doing it. It's just not as good. It's better when we were doing it. But we saw something that was polluting and decided we shouldn't. The phones are actually a revolutionary technology that we completely forget how. And I know that's because we think, oh, we're screen addicted and it's stressful. And I get that. I'm one of those people. I'm always getting pinged on my phone. But if you give someone in a developing country access to a phone, and there's studies on this, they have access to banking. That's life changing for them. Now I can get a job. Now I can get a credit score. Now I can get access to moving money around. Like it's everything. And if you give them, if they have enough education that, because obviously not all of these areas are literate, that they can access the internet. Now they have education. Now they have a form of healthcare. It might not be perfect. It might not be the same as going to a doctor. But let me tell you, if you don't have access to a doctor, it is life-saving. It is life-saving. You can look up anything on there. And I think we forget this. Right? Like we completely forget that if you or I are in trouble, aside from the systems that will help us, we have a fallback. And it's hard to imagine a world without that knowledge, unless maybe you grew up with it. But even then you had doctors and you had teachers. When I was in the the Punjab, I remember trying to think, how can I help these people? And it was never give them money. The money's not going to do anything because it's the infrastructure that's lacking. But if you give them a phone, and we did actually do this, funded for them to have a phone. The issue is, without electricity, runs out of battery, and you have to go into the city, which costs money, and there's no like bus service. You have to like wait for someone with a motorbike to take you. Or sometimes there's a guy with like a horse and cart. Actually, it was a donkey and cart. And they might be able to take you, but it's not like a regular service. Anyway, then you could sit in a cafe and charge it potentially and then bring it home. But in that couple of hours that you have juice on there, you can set up banking. You can look up, how do I treat my son who has this illness? You could look up symptoms that are actually tuberculosis. And people have trialed this, where they found in communities where they have tuberculosis, one of the reasons it spreads is because people don't know how to prevent it. So just telling them simple stuff, wash your hands, don't touch fluids, simple stuff that they don't know, it changes people's lives. It stops the spread. So that is something that I constantly hear people complain about. And I do it myself sometimes, that I think actually it's been such an equalizer. Maybe not for us because we already have everything else, but for everyone else in the world, that has been so monumental. And actually AI is going to be as well. Even if we have frustrations with it here, for them, people are making software where you can use your voice. So you don't have to be literate. I mean, that's life-changing technology. That's game-changing. They're also making apps where they'll translate languages that are going out of use, so people can communicate and access an entire world of knowledge, essentially for free, the cost of a phone, occasionally being able to charge it. But it still always comes down to, ideally, you want to be able to use it 24/7 so that the 50 people in the village aren't just sharing this one piece of tech that then runs out of battery.
That sounds like the type of story, if we tell more widely, whether in fictional terms or in documentary terms, is the type of thing that might change the narrative, right? From the one that you were talking about, you were growing up with. I want to both thank you and I think apologize for mispronouncing your name. Is it Zion?
That's okay. Or? Yes, it is.
It is. Okay. So we have not been talking to Zion Lights. But Zion Lights, and the book is Energy is Life. Thanks so much for talking to Reason.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.